listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much of what we throw into the garbage makes its way into our oceans? And how can consumers be made to understand the global impact of a throwaway culture? When adventurer and environmentalist David de Rothschild read a UN report that stated every square mile of the Earth's oceans contains 46,000 pieces of floating plastic garbage, he was sure the figure must be a typo. When he learned it was not, he committed himself to demonstrating not only how much waste is out there, but also to the fact that plastic is highly recyclable, and that throwing away items that will remain in the environment for hundreds of years after a single use is unnecessary and unsustainable. David de Rothschild conceived the Plastiki Project and oversaw the construction of an off-the-grid sailing expedition for a boat made entirely of recycled materials, including 12,500 used plastic water bottles. His new book about the experience is called Plastiki, Across the Pacific on Plastic, An Adventure to Save Our Oceans. David, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me on the show.
For people who are wondering why the name Plastiki sounds familiar, it's because it's a play on the name of the craft that Thor Heyerdahl built for his famous voyage in 1947.
Yeah, exactly that. It's a play on the Kon-Tiki, and it was after a conversation I had with a film producer, and I was trying to sell the idea of actually taking a bunch of artists out to this eastern garbage patch, this area of our ocean, which is basically collecting all this trash because of the way the currents are and the way it pulls all the anything that ends up in our ocean is basically aggregated by the currents, and so these jars are filling up. And my plan was to take a bunch of artists, go out there, pick up some of the rubbish, come back to shore, get them to create sculptures, and then show these sculptures all over the world. And this film producer sort of turned around to me and said, hey, you know, I make stories, and that's a great story and really exciting, but if it's really twice the size of Texas or as large as you say it is, and it's not like you're not going to find it. You know, where is the drama? Where is the narrative? Where is the sort of suspense? And I remember leaving that meeting thinking, he's right, you know, where is the drama? And when you think about ocean expeditions and you think about them over the last century or the last 50 years, what is the one that jumps out was the Kon-Tiki, Thor Heyerdahl and his men sailing on their balsawood raft in 1947 across the South Pacific. And I was suddenly sort of struck by this idea of, well, you know, we've got the Kon-Tiki, why not call it the Plastiki? And it sort of stuck from there. And that's where it sort of began. I think the name really brought a lot of people into the project. They sort of smiled and went, if this is going to be half as crazy as the Kon-Tiki was when it first started as an idea, then I want to be involved. And that's what we wanted. We wanted people to be involved and just jump on, and that's what a lot of people did.
And among the people involved was Heyerdahl's grandson.
Yeah, that was quite a moment. It was I was chasing him for quite a while, you know, trying to get him to come on. And I was like, you know, sending in these proposals. Finally, one day, I said, look, I'm doing this talk in France at this biomarine conference. Would you be interested in joining me for a few days? He finally turned up, and I said, so I guess you've seen all the materials, you've read everything. And he said, no, I never received anything. And I was like, so you've just turned up here. So yeah, because you've phoned me now for the last 2 years trying to persuade me to come. I thought this guy, you know, I have to see what this guy is all about. And obviously the connection to my grandfather, I thought, would be interesting. And so he came over not knowing what he was going to get involved in. And he was, you know, really just the most inspiring crew member. And to have that connection with the Kon-Tiki for me was a really important part of the conversation, because one of the lines that came out of the 1947 documentary in the book that they created was really this idea that the oceans was, you know, full of life, was abundant, you know, and there was life everywhere. And, you know, when you come back now to 2010, or come forward rather to 2010, you realize how dead our oceans are and how tragic it is that really, rather than lots of fish living in our ocean, lots of plastic.
Yeah, for people who haven't seen that documentary, during the documentary, they're concerned about sharks the whole time. There's, like, marine life jumping up on the decks.
It's a little violent, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, now you watch it and you're like, okay, he's hitting a shark on the head with his, like, food trunk. And you're sort of like, and there's one moment where they're like, and then a whale, because it's so matter-of-fact, like, and then a whale came towards us. Had to decide whether we would shoot it or not. You're like, okay, that's not so eco-friendly.
and you guys hardly even caught any fish the whole time.
Yeah, I'm gonna blame that on nature, not on my bad fishing. I'm gonna blame that on the fact that our oceans are empty. Nothing to do with the fact that I'm probably an appalling fisherman using the wrong lures, going at the wrong speed. No, but seriously, it really was the one thing that, you know, I noticed. And you know, you do think at sea, you know, you're going to see lots of things, and you're going to, there's going to be that abundance. And you know, you go and watch films like Ocean, and it's, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's almost, it's in a way, if I can say it, it's become sort of nature pornography. It's like, mm-hmm. oh my God, breaching whales and massive schools of dolphins and yeah. everything's alive. And then you get out there and you're like, hello, where is everybody? You know, and you realize that, you know, these reports saying that 80% of our giant fish stock is in decline or collapsed. You know, there's a reason for that. You know, it's because we are literally trawling our oceans for fish. We haven't put any plans in place at all to make it sustainable. The tuna is like the, you know, market is the chicken of the ocean. Now, imagine if we had tried to eat all the chicken that we eat today just trying to round up wild chickens.
Yeah.
I don't think we'd really have any chicken on our plate. But, you know, we don't do that in the ocean. We go out and grab all these fish, but we don't stop and let the ocean breathe. And I think that's what we need to start doing.
Is the problem, David, that you know, we have to, somebody owns the land on which chickens are farmed or, I suppose, a very long time ago hunted. Today, a lot of fishing takes place in international waters that are not governed in the same way.
You've hit the nail on the head, 100%. And you know, this is the problem. There is no ownership, so there's no responsibility. You know, you go to the airport and you go and hire a car, and the person says, would you like to take out some more insurance? It'd be another $5. And basically it means that you can abuse our car. And you go, oh, yeah, sounds fine. Mm-hmm. Why not? I don't own it. I can park it anywhere. I can leave the windows down. If someone bumps my bumper, I don't care. You know, you return it with rubbish in it. I mean, you know, you just don't look after it. It's not yours. And because we've done that, apart from really mineral extraction rights and, you know, this sort of, the sort of very close shore rights that are given out, you know, depending on where it is, between 12 and 200 miles for extraction rights of minerals, mainly oil, you know, we have still this crazy sort of high seas law that you can do anything. In fact, you and me, you know, we own that. You know, it's us. You know, as citizens on this planet, we each have equal rights. Land is very, very different. You know, the oceans, they're still unowned. And because of that, we abuse the system. And then we do crazy things like we try and create fishing quotas, which are really important. But what happens is our fishing is so indiscriminate, it picks up everything. It just trawls everything. So these massive, massive, you know, super tankers that can produce 200, or process rather, 200 tons of fish a day, 200 tons of fish a day, nets, as you could fit 12 jumbo jets in the mouths of these nets as they trawl the ocean. And then they go, oops, we're over quota, so what do? We'll just dump half of that back into sea. Most of it is dead already because it's been pulled out of the ocean on the deck. So we create these systems. We now know there's a big, big problem with these systems, and we need to change it. We need to take responsibility, and we need to create you know, some sort of ownership around the oceans, because it covers 72% of our planet. It's not a small amount. You know, we should have called it planet ocean rather than planet Earth.
And for people who still really want to eat seafood, it's getting easier and easier to know whether you're making a responsible choice or an irresponsible one. I even downloaded it as an iPhone app. The Monterey Aquarium has a guide.
It's great. It's really simple. We actually used it in the book. There's a guide in there that shows people, you know, what you can eat, what to avoid. You know, and it's like anything. It's just, you know, using your common sense. I find it amazing. You'll go to a restaurant and, you know, you'll just say, I'll have some fish, please. And I'll say, okay, this is the special. And great, thank you very much. And you put it in your mouth and you eat it. You don't ask any questions. People will go into an electronics store and ask more about their new, you know, gadget, how long the battery lasts, how light it is, what resolution the screen is, how much memory it is. They'll ask 1,000 questions. But they won't ask a single question about where their food comes from and they're putting it inside their body and what the impact that it has on the planet. So I think what it is about, stage one, as you said, download a guide, get curious, or even just ask the waiter in a restaurant, say to them, hey, where is this coming from? You know, it's like, I was in an award ceremony not long ago, an environmental award ceremony, and, you know, it's talking about, you know, champions of the ocean, and there were lots of great champions of the ocean there, and they were serving Chilean sea bass. I was like, come on, guys. You know, and they're like, oh, well, someone forgot to inform the caterers that it's a, you know, an ocean, you know, it's an ocean, you know, award thing, and it's meant to be, you know, this thing, and for the environment. And I was like, you know, such a disconnect. And it's that's what we need to do, is get curious. And it is getting easier. And, you know, we can now start to monitor fish. We have a funny little campaign on our website called Fish Free Friday. Let the fish do something else on Friday, which is kind of fun. So there's some funny illustrations on there as well, if you want to look at the more humorous side of this. There is some illustrations on our website you can look at as well.
We will link to your website. We'll also link to the Monterey Aquarium site so people can check that out. It's one thing, David, to conceive of this really cool boat made of entirely recycled items and of plastic trash. It's another thing to have one that is seaworthy be designed. Talk about where you went for help and the different iterations along the way.
So the first stage of the project, as you highlighted at the beginning of the show, started with reading this report back in 2006. I was kind of shocked. I was like, okay, that's a joke. Someone's got this wrong. I went online. I started researching and realized actually, you know, that was sort of a conservative estimate.
And some of it's really tiny for people who are like, I can't believe that. It's sometimes it breaks up into tiny pieces, but
it does,
still there.
And most of it is. So what we'll see, a lot of people say, well, I've read about this and I've gone online and I can't see any real photos of these islands. Mm-hmm. Let's just dispel the myth now. It's not islands of trash. I mean, it's, you know, it's easy to call it an island of trash, but really it's fragments of plastic that photodegrade. So with the UV light, they break down. And ever since 1907, when Leo Hendrik Bakelind produced Bakelite, the first fully synthetic plastic, every bit of plastic that's ever been produced is somewhere on our planet, either in our atmosphere through incineration, in landfill, buried, or somewhere in our natural environments like our oceans. And so it breaks down into tiny, tiny pieces, so it's subsurface, hard to see. So the imagination expects, you know, you can see trash Crusoe and all these things on the island, but it's really much more ominous. And that leads into a bigger issue, which we can talk about later, which is toxicity in the food supply chain. Mm-hmm. But 2006, I read this article, I go out, I find an architect who's actually only ever designed buildings before. I said, have you ever, you know, would you be interested in doing a boat? Have you ever thought about designing a boat? He said, no. I was like, perfect, you're my man. no preconceived ideas. You come at it with a fresh lens. He was actually known for being one of the lead architects on the Eden project, which was a huge biosphere in the south of England. And his whole sort of remit was nature-inspired design, biomimicry. Mm-hmm. So the first stage was we put together these incredible mood boards, concepts, ideas of how nature could inform the design of the vessel. And this went on for about 18 months. Finally, very excited, we went out to a load of naval architects, you know, and walked around very proud with all these beautiful brown paper drawings and concepts and ideas and conversations we'd had, and we were very confident about it all. And finally, after sort of, you know, sitting down with a number of naval architects, one of them called Andy DeVal decided, you know, he wanted to take on this challenge, which was effectively the boat needed to use bottles in their original form, so they needed to be visible, and they needed to be functionable. And so we showed him our design with these visible functional bottles in the design, phase one design, and he literally looked at us and said, you two have never been to sea before, have you? We're like, nope. he goes, really nice what you've done. You've had a really fun 2 years, I'm sure, but I hate to burst your bubble. This is going to break apart, and you won't get out of the Bay Area.
You will die.
You will die. There's huge forces, unbelievable forces. And I was like, come on, we can, you know, surely we can massage this a little bit. And he was like, no. There's a reason why boats look like boats and not like pond skating catamarans with, you know, like little pond skaters, you know, on the ponds. Like, we had this crazy design, actually. It's in a very early chapter of the book. It shows you some of the early designs. And he said to us, you know, lovely idea, nice pictures, but crazy. And so he took over the project in sort of late 2007, early 2008, started putting together some more traditional-looking drawings based on Polynesian cutters and on Polynesian boats and vessels. And effectively, we came up with the design that you now see as the plasticky design. And he pretty much nailed it straight away. And what he did was he basically said, look, we need to separate out the buoyancy and the frame.
Let me have you stop there, and we will have a little cliffhanger as we take a quick break here. My guest is David de Rothschild, an environmentalist adventurer. His new book is called Plastiki, Across the Pacific on Plastic, An Adventure to Save Our Oceans. Chris Boyd, you're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is environmentalist adventurer David de Rothschild. His new book is called Plastiki, Across the Pacific on Plastic, An Adventure to Save Our Oceans. So, David, you had Andy saying you can't use these original designs, which were fanciful and beautiful. You need to have something seaworthy. Did Michael's original idea to sort of think about how pomegranate seeds are put together, did that make its way to the final design?
Yeah, as I was saying, you know, he effectively said we needed to split the design into a frame structure and a buoyancy. And the buoyancy was coming, obviously, from our bottles, and that was the first big challenge. And that's when Michael had really, set out this challenge of saying, look, if we pack together the bottles in this sort of star structure and pack it out with sort of the equivalent of pith, which is what you find inside a pomegranate, we could create a very strong structure. So the conversation and the sort of packing out of the system to pack it out did make its way through. Not in entirety, but it definitely was one of the influences of how we actually managed to, in the end, pack the bottles together. So some of the very early drawings that we did with these sort of wedges of bottles, actually came to fruition. And a big part of the conversation of the plasticky wasn't always to take everything through to realization, but was just having that conversation which stimulated, people's imagination. And there's definitely, I'm sure of it, going to be lots of other innovations that have come out of plasticky, post-plasticky, just because of the people that we had involved, people who were, combining different areas of expertise, had an ability, not be afraid to ask stupid questions. I mean, when you're saying to somebody, we're building a boat out of plastic bottles to sail across the Pacific, so all of a sudden the ego disappears. People can ask the craziest questions and find innovation from the most unexpected places, especially when you're mixing material scientists with artists, artists with architects, architects with poets, poets with biologists, and sailors with, surveyors or whatever it was, and you're mixing this incredible eclectic group of people. It starts to, sort of churn up and throw up all these great new conversations and new ideas around solutions. So that was a big part of it, was, saying list of solutions is bigger than a list of problems. So Andy DeVal took over. He started to, as I said, put together these smart drawings, these more conventional vessel-looking, sketches, which then in 2008, after kind of really looking around about materials, we started the actual sort of main construction. And we were still running at that stage on this belief that we could find this sort of superstructure material other than just the plywood to keep the bottles in place. And that was a really big kind of, turning point in the project, really. And that was one of the sort of big innovation pieces, but also one of the sort of moments where I went through this idea of sort of, or rather less of an idea, but went through the sort of conversations in my head and with close friends, like, have I bitten off more than I can chew?
Yeah. And you guys literally invented a new way of recycling plastic.
Yeah, it's a new process. I mean, what we did was we looked around, and it was really a sort of a quote from Buckminster Fuller, Robert Buckminster Fuller, a great engineer and architect.
From Texas.
And he effectively quoted as saying, there is no such thing as waste. We're just merely ignorant, or pollution rather. We're merely ignorant of the value of the material. So all of a sudden I thought, well, actually, that's really interesting. We need to find people who are doing interesting things that give plastic infinite potential rather than a valueless, disposable way of being. And so what happens with us is our mentality is that, it's just cheap, it's valueless, it's throwaway. People always go, well, we collect aluminium cans. Because in a way, the potential of an aluminium can is perceived to be far greater, because you can turn an aluminium can into a wing of an airplane or into a building or into something with much greater value. Whereas with plastic, we generally just think of it as disposable, and it fits with that kind of disposability of our society nowadays, our mentality. So I suddenly stopped the project and said, look, we need to find people who are innovating materials in a smart way that can become, as Bill McDonough and Michael Brownhart say in their book Cradle to Cradle, can become the nutrition for something else, can become this closed-loop material. So we found a group out in Denmark who were basically producing a PET fabric, and we went to another group who were producing a PET foam, and then we started to tinker, figure out, could we actually take these two components that were being used totally separately in totally different applications, could we put this process together, could we figure out a process to make this become our superstructure? And we did, and it was only because I think we were just, just stubborn and curious and not afraid to fail, and did a lot more D than R probably, and we just kept on tinkering in our oven of our rental house in San Francisco, much to the annoyance of my landlord, who lived upstairs when he was come downstairs and was smelling of burnt plastic. He was like, what the hell are you guys cooking in there? But we did. We managed to figure it out, and that became, this superstructure, this what we're calling Ceratex, which is a self-reinforcing textile.
So your other goal for the craft was that it be as off the grid as possible. You knew you wanted the ability to communicate with people back on shore, and you wanted to be able to talk from a public relations perspective to people who were interested in the voyage, and you wanted some safety gear, but essentially you didn't want to have any kind of motor on board at all.
Yeah, that's correct. We wanted to, again, I'd have to go back to Bucky, to quote him again, Mr. Buckminster Fuller, you know, he said, we live on Spaceship Earth. And really, the Plasticky was our little spaceship, you know. And here we were on the sustainability, you know, platform. And as you said, we wanted to make it obvious that actually the solutions exist to the problems that we're seeing today. So we totally took all our energy footprint to renewables. So we went over to solar, to wind, human generated through our bike machine for a human dynamo. We had sea turbines that you could throw over the side as well to generate electricity. We had our own vertical garden on the back to grow our own food. We worked with all the local sort of farmers in San Francisco. There's an incredible farmers market, so we had the chance to work with them to get the most sustainable local organic food and produce that we packaged before we went and hung before we went and did all these great things so that it was as sustainable and as seasonal as possible. We made sure that everything on the boat was either handmade by us or was as sustainable and reclaimed as possible. And that's really hard because there's a really sort of dirty secret of sailing, is that sailing is most beautiful, you know, and everyone puts up the sails, it's all out there on the ocean, it's in the elements, but a lot of the gear that's used in sailing are these monster hybrid materials, the carbon fibers, they're very, very energy intensive, they run generators and water makers and all these things, and so we really had a challenge to try and run a vessel without, as you said, an engine. We did have a little outboard engine, which we kept basically if someone was to fall overboard. It was really the last chance for someone if we could try and turn this vessel around, which we, even that, we had it converted so we could run it on biodiesel, on a biofuel. So, but you know, it really was a challenge because a lot of the tools that you'd expect with GPS and modern communication, they suck a lot of energy. So we had to be really smart with how we planned that. And that was also in its own right a massive undertaking.
And when you had set sail and there wasn't a lot of sunshine or a lot of different sustainable sources of power, the things that you would have to give up were like powering your iPod and getting on email and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and you know, you sort of, everybody wants to connect and write a blog and listen to music. And nowadays everyone was, you know, it was like, guys, that's, you know, we created a mini library because everyone was like, oh, I'm going to bring my new electronic book. And I'm like, well, that's kind of cool, but at the same time, you're going to be kind of bummed out if we get, you know, a week's worth of very little sun, and you're going to maybe have to, you know, sing a song or talk to one of your other crew members. God forbid. Imagine that. It's a novel idea. you know, so it was, you know, but all in all, you know, obviously navigation tools and sort of the main what I call life support system for the boat took precedent over everything, and that was communication and making sure that we could, you know, update our charts, our weather position, all the rest of that. Everything else was secondary, but we never really went too short on anything. I mean, we had a few days where we had some really, really overcast skies. Our batteries got very, very low. Our wind turbines provided most of our energy. Our solar also provided a lot of energy as well. We had, you know, 800 watts on the roof and also on the back as well. So we had a really good solar array. And, it, you know, life on board, I have to say this because I've done some other expeditions, you know, compared to being skiing with 16 dogs across the Arctic Ocean, this was, you know, very, very comfortable, really good food, very comfortable in comparison. There was still a lot of, you know, bits to it that I wouldn't want to wish on to anybody.
Well, I will say you set the bar for comfort rather low based on your
I was going to say I do set it rather low. The sort of salty moments where you haven't had any fresh water on your body, really, apart from just drinking water, but you haven't had any fresh water in your body for nearly 40 days, and you get very salty, very sore, very cracked, in the heat, a little smelly. I remember one time, actually, on off watch, fast asleep, I hear this banging, and I think, oh, my God, something's happening to the vessel. I jump out of my bunk, and I go outside, and my entire crew is standing there naked on the deck, soap in hand, cloth in hand, and I'm like, what is going on? And I look over, and they're like, look, there's a squall on the horizon. Quick, grab your soap. We're going to get a wash. And, you know, these rain clouds would come past, and everyone would be out there washing away, trying desperately to make sure they got the soap off them before the rain stopped. Otherwise, you kind of caught a cropper with suds and salt and back to square one, which was never good. So you basically tried to wash as quickly as possible and hope that it would keep on raining.
And the water thing was a concern. You had with you drinking water so that you knew that no one would die of thirst. But you finally found after a few weeks that the onboard garden just took too much water to be sustainable.
Yeah, it was a real shame. It was a real, you know, it was one of those moments where you have to make a choice. Does the kale get it, or do one of our crew members or all of us get it? So we had to give up on the garden just before we got to Christmas Island, which was really, really, really sad. But basically, we saw no rain for 30-odd days, 37 days. We saw literally no rain, or 35 days, no rain. And it was only probably the last week before we got to Christmas Island we actually saw some rain. And we designed a cabin to capture rainwater. We were expecting a lot more rain. The garden was consuming a lot more water than we'd anticipated and was doing really well. Everyone was like, it's not going to do well. Had we a water maker and, you know, the ability just to kind of keep on producing water, then that would have been fine. But we did have to make that choice. And there was a lot of different methods from, you know, some heavy pruning of the vessel, of the garden to try and cut out the number of plants, the number of water needed. We tried to shade it. We tried to, a few of us tried to pee on it. Not that that would have been great, but we tried everything to keep it alive, and it didn't really end up winning the battle of no water. And that was one of the big concerns for me anyway, was, you know, we didn't know how long we were going to be out there. We're not a vessel that's very steerable, as you can imagine. We can only really much go downwind. We're reliant, obviously, totally on the wind. And there were days where we just sit there, days and days, and then when the water's running out. And the irony is that everything that you eat generally was salty. So a lot of it's, you know, dehydrated and salty. So you're eating salty food, running out of water in tropical heat, and you're sort of, you know, it does play on the mind.
And you couldn't often get out and sort of jump off and take a swim because there was a concern that you would lose the boat if that happened.
Yeah, it sounds like a, you know, it's kind of an odd thing to say, but, you know, the boat really, you know, moves pretty fast even when you don't think it's moving fast. And so, one, obviously you're on a mission to get to where you're going. And two, you didn't want to lose any crew members. And so we only had a few occasions where it really was dead calm that we could jump in and swim underneath the boat. And those were some of the most magical. The first time I remember diving into this hypnotic blue and off the side of the vessel and just diving down and down and down. It felt so good to be in the water. It was actually still quite cold, the water quite fresh. And then coming up and then suddenly getting a little pang of anxiety going, I'm in the middle of nowhere. This is insane. And then you suddenly get comfortable with it again and you start to recognize that, you know, it's you're so blessed to have that opportunity to see this, that we have to share this message. And one of the downsides and one of the tragedies of that moment, I'll never forget it, was swimming around under the vessel, doing an inspection of the bottles and seeing all these flecks of plastic floating past my mask. And these were, you know, flecks of plastic, effectively, as we talked earlier, the plastic breaks down into these small pieces right below the surface of the ocean. And here we were, 1,000-odd miles away from any, you know, sort of human intervention, as it were, from any, you know, habitats. And this is what we were seeing, these human fingerprints floating in the ocean. And you just, you know, it's pretty despairing and very depressing.
Talk about this for a moment, David. Most of us would say, well, I don't throw my trash directly in the ocean, and yet there's so much out there. How does it get from when we last used it into the ocean to be breaking apart and poisoning the fish and the ecosystem?
You know, there's a number of ways. One is obviously, you know, beachgoers leaving stuff around the beach. It's, you know, sounds like, you think, well, how many people go to the beach and leave stuff? But you'd be surprised how many people go and have a picnic and leave a bag or a, you know, popsicle or toys and things like that. You know, most of the landfills that we have as well, most of them, oddly enough, tend to be near waterways, near river systems, or near the coast. And so sometimes there's a lot of that is blowing off from landfills. Plastic bags blow around very easily, and they blow out to sea. Container ships and tourist ships and military vessel and fishing fleets, you know, constantly dropping rubbish at sea is another one. And finally, just, you know, from you know, whether you're in a city that you think is, you know, nowhere near the ocean, whenever there is a connection to any bit of water, whether it's a lake or land, everything's connected. So you drop something out the window of your car and you don't think anything about it, or you drop something on the street and think, oh, I won't bother picking it up, and it goes down the drain, it gets into the system, and it washes out to sea eventually. It will work its way out to sea. So after heavy storms, you see a huge amount of trash coming off the land, ending up in our ocean. And there are now systems in place, as these big sort of trash deflection units that try and capture all of the trash. And I was actually talking to someone not long ago in Los Angeles about this, and they were saying they're spending $18 million a year just trying to keep on top of the problem. Not that's not improving it. It's not doing, you know, it's not making any major. It's not, that's not giving back to anybody. I mean, that's $18 million a year on a needless problem. That actually, if we change that, you can say, well, imagine what the $18 million could do in that local community for education or healthcare or, you know, for improvements to the community, where you could actually see incremental changes year on year. This is literally $18 million just to try and keep on top of it, and they're still not keeping on top of it. And that's trying to keep plastic bags and bottles and everything out of the ocean. And a lot of people say, well, let's just let it go in the ocean. Really, what's the damage? Well, the damage on an environmental scale is enormous. I mean, as I said, it effectively gets into the stomachs of marine mammals, marine birds. Millions of marine birds are dying every year. You're an albatross. You're flying thousands of miles. You scoop up what you think is shrimp and krill, and really it's a red lighter or it's a red lid from a soda bottle. Mm. You go back and you then put it into your nest, into your chickling. And the second piece is the plastic actually, as I said, breaks down into these small pieces. And this is where it gets into the food system. So what's happening is the filter feeders live in the life layer, the little guys who drive life on our ocean. They suck up this plastic, they get eaten by the bigger guys, and it works its way back up the food chain. So now we've got a toxicity issue because the plastic attracts all the toxins that are ending up in our ocean. They're tiny little nodules of highly toxic substances, you know, that are running off the land from agriculture and industry, from our river systems, into our ocean, and that gets back into you and me.
David DeRothschild is my guest. He's an environmental adventurer and author of the new book, Plastiki, Across the Pacific on Plastic, An Adventure to Save Our Oceans. Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David DeRothschild. His new book is called Plastiki, Across the Pacific on Plastic, An Adventure to Save Our Oceans. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we meet up with Reeves in Dallas. Hi, Reeves.
Hi, Chris. Glad you could take my call. I just really applaud you having this gentleman on, and I think it's tragic what's happened to our oceans. I'm up there in years, so I remember when it was full of life. And anyhow, on a personal basis, I just wonder if we couldn't all decide not to use plastic, because I go to the grocery store, and if I can possibly buy something in glass, I choose that. And then I take my own coffee cup, which I put in my I wash at home, to Starbucks. And then, you know, there are a number of ways, like if I go to a restaurant and wanting something to take out, I take my own container, and you should cooperate with me. I think, you know, with 7.5 billion people on the planet living the way we do, if there would be any way in this world we could return to something that was low-tech, you know, the way it used to be. I mean, it sounds pretty hopeless, but just wonder if the public consciousness could be brought to bear on this.
Well, they sound like great ideas, Reeves. What do you think, David?
I totally agree. I applaud you for coming on the show and sharing, you know, the solutions with us, because what you've just said is totally true. We need to start looking and saying, look, as you said, we have a population increase. We have resources that are in shortage. We know that. And if you think about it, it's like, does it make sense to put all this energy into extracting something from the ground, distributing it, manufacturing it, doing all these things to get it to you and me, that then just throw it away and bury it? It doesn't make sense. So what we need to do is start reusing, we need to reduce, and we need to basically refuse those single-use plastics that we're seeing in our ocean. And we fundamentally just need to rethink our system and take some of those things offline today and start an innovation race. I mean, if someone said, let's ban plastic bags, all of a sudden you'd have all these great home-spun bags coming out, you'd have an entrepreneurial race, you'd create micro-economies for people, they could sew bags, create bags, share bags. You know, and it's all there. The solutions are there. What we need to do, and I hate to say this, is just find some leaders, some politicians who will make, you know, the long-term decisions rather than these short-term populist vote-winning kind of decisions that aren't helping our environment.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go back to the phones now. This time, speak with Andrew in Dallas. Hi, Andrew.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. I was curious. I know that for a number of years we had trouble with cruise ships that were you know, dumping trash in the oceans. And my wife and I had the good fortune to be on a junk boat in Halong Bay in Vietnam for a couple nights. And when we were coming back, there was a cruise ship in front of us, and it was very clear that they had just dumped all their trash. And it was a horrific sight to see, especially so close to shore. I would have thought they would have done it further out. But I'm just curious what's being done in other countries to try to rein in on that kind of thing.
You know, there's a lot of, again, a brilliant observation and a sad observation, a very true observation of a lot of these ships go out carrying trash and then they just dump it at sea, thinking it's an endless horizon. So what we're seeing now is a lot more mandatory recycling. There's basically when cruise ships come into port, they have to show that they still have their trash on board. They're making it a lot easier for them now to recycle, putting recycling centers in the ports. And so they have to be accountable for where their trash is. If they suddenly come back after a two-week cruise and there's no trash, it's like, okay, it's gone somewhere. They can get fined. So it's starting to happen, but super slow because, as we said in the very beginning, no one owns the oceans. So everyone says, well, it's free for all. I can do it out there. There's no law. So we have to start legislating in the ports.
We haven't had much of an opportunity to talk about your crew, but it sounds like you had a really phenomenal group of people who were with you for parts of the voyage, including a filmmaker documenting the trip who made maybe not the ultimate sacrifice, but a really, really extraordinary one in order to be with you.
An extraordinary one. I mean, this is. I have some odd thing that happens to me on expeditions. Vern Mern, who was our filmmaker on board, his wife was pregnant, and, you know, but when he left and he made this decision and he said, listen, I could be at sea, and in the end he was at sea. It was almost a year ago to the day. His baby boy, Grizzly, William Grizzly Moen, was actually born while at sea via Skype, of all things, on Earth Day. Luckily, it was a boy. I said he'll forgive his father. If it was a girl, he would have, you know, mummy and the daughter would have probably never have forgiven. the son's going to be like, Dad, you're a hero to me. So yeah. I said, you've won the sort of the admiration of your son. But yeah, it was it most surreal. It was an Earth Day baby, and his wife gave birth. And luckily, we had the communications that we could actually allow him to sort of share that moment with his wife on Skype. It's not the perfect ending, I guess, but at least they had some moments together. And it's crazy to think it's a year ago today, and little Grizzly will be a year tomorrow on Earth Day. So kind of exciting.
And he's watching the birth via Skype while you're like in another part of the cabin trying to have an interview with Al Jazeera. Is this right?
Yeah. The whole thing, it was comical, and I just didn't know how to do it because we had one camera was going and filming. One crew member, you know, was kind of laughing and making jokes about the whole thing. Vern, all I can hear is like, can you see the head? Push, breathe, push. You know, oh my God, it's a boy. No, it's not out, is it? You know, and this whole sort of thing's going on. At the same time, you know, we're doing this live Earth Day special to Al Jazeera, you know, and there's, you know, all the listeners are listening in and they're saying, now tell us about the plastic. And all I can hear is Vern crying and screaming in the background. Finally, I just had to say, listen, I'm really sorry. I can't quite concentrate. One of our crew members is, you know, his wife's having a baby, and they're like, you're having a baby on board? I was like, no, we're not on board. There's someone else is having a baby. We've got to go. So I had to hang up. it was a little bit of one of those moments I will never forget.
So I have to ask you about this. Obviously, with Plastiki, you proved that this was possible. First of all, what condition was the boat in by the time you were finished? Was it pretty beat up, or was it in good enough shape to sail again?
She was definitely, I think there's big lessons we learned from the design, like the point loading where we put the rigging in was definitely starting to bend the boat. Put it this way, I wouldn't want to go much further on her. You know, and I think this is the thing. We arrived and everyone's like, yay, well done, you made it. And at the end of the day, yes, it was great and it was a part of the puzzle. But it really, to me, is only the start of the now. And, you know, we still have this stupid, crazy plastic problem. We cover everything in plastic. The other day I was reading a report, an advert for a banana, that single-wrap banana wrapped in plastic. I mean, a banana is the best wrapping in the world that nature gives us.
Yes.
And then they go and wrap it in some plastic, and then they have the audacity to say, it's bioplastic, so we're a green company. You're like, no, just don't wrap my banana or my avocado, all these things. It doesn't need it. It's going to be eaten and thrown out. So why wrap it in plastic? We do have a crazy consumption for plastic. Plastic is not going to disappear. Let's get honest about it. It isn't going to disappear. So what we need to do is we need to change the value perception. We need to eliminate those single-use plastics, like I said, the plastic bags, styrofoam. I mean, Starfilm should have gone out of fashion with Tom Cruise in the 80s. Should have just gone. and you know, we have to get smart about this and really not look at, you know, or start looking at the bigger picture and say, if we are continuing to use these single-use plastics, we're just going to keep on chogging up the system, we're going to blocking the system. And then we have to say the other types of plastic that you find in your heart-saving machinery or you find it in other areas, that type of plastic, you know, we have to make sure it becomes nutrition for another item, that it's reclaimed, it's revalued, and we see the infinite potential rather than seeing it as a valueless throwaway item.
We've talked about this plastic breaking up in the ocean, but the reality is that something that stays on land, it doesn't break down for something like 400 years. Is that right?
Yeah, it really doesn't. So you'll see plastic fingerprints on land a lot sooner. And I think this is interesting to come back to the value perception. If you think about it, diamonds, you know, commonly found, but they're controlled by a few companies. They last forever. So the narrative that was painted around them was it was a symbol of eternity, mm-hmm. Lasts forever. Valuable because it lasts forever and it's super tough, it's super shiny. And so the message was, you know, these are very valuable items. Plastic is controlled by a few companies, commonly found, and the story around them, even though they last forever, as you've just said, I mean, literally last forever, as long as diamonds, the story we've been told is it's valueless.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a narrative that we've just got to repaint. And I there's a lot of women out there going, is he saying we need to get rid of our diamond wedding rings? No, I'm not. But I'm just saying, look at the stories. And one has become a priceless item that everyone reveres as aspirational. The other one is seen as totally valueless. And it's only because of marketing. So what we need to do is just change the story. And that's what the plastic key was trying to do, is like help people change the story. The plastic can be reused. It can be resourced. And if we can build a boat out of plastic bottles and sail across the Pacific, you can sure try and cut your consumption of plastic on a daily basis.
And it's really stunning that the amount of plastic we use, the vast majority of it, even though it's really convenient to recycle it these days, the vast majority of it does not get recycled. Is that still true?
100% true. I mean, on your soda bottles, we're really only around 20%. Globally on plastic, we're around 7% recycling rate. 7%. It's 300 billion PET soda bottles used every year. Think about that. And so where do they go? Only 20% of those are actually being reclaimed. So the rest of them are ending up somewhere. And that's why we're seeing this in our ocean. That's why we're seeing this in, you know, as you said, in natural environments on the land. We're seeing this sort of plastic scourge, and it's taking over our planet. And so we have to start recognizing that we need to reclaim it. We need to make it valuable. To give someone incentive, in the U.S. alone, just on PET bottles, they estimate around $1.2 to $1.3 billion worth of raw PET resin is being buried in landfill. That becomes exciting for someone. If someone, you know, if there's gold in them landfills, if we can get smart about it and reclaim it, there is money for people to be made. So maybe that needs to be incentive. Maybe it's an economic driver that will get people to recognize that this is a raw material we're burying. You would never go out and bury that much aluminium because, as I said, the perception is you can build a car, a plane. Well, we can do all of that. We built a boat, so why can't we build other structures?
Well, with the price of petroleum climbing, I mean, do people not make that connection that plastic comes from oil?
You would think they do, but no, sadly not. So, the marketplace will probably drive it out. It will become cost prohibitive, which is hopefully a good thing, and which is a great thing, obviously. But when you start to think about plastic, and you say, well, I guess they say we have to separate it up. What are you going to make that heart, you know, saving machinery from? Or what are we going to make certain items that we just essentially need? Are we going to take that oil and that plastic and put it into something that we're just going to throw away and bury after 20 minutes? Or are we going to actually put it into resources that will last a long time? And so we need to start thinking smart about those resources. But as you said, you know, plastic is oil-based. It's really toxic. It's full of carcinogenic properties. So it seems crazy to me that we are literally surrounding ourselves with it. When you think about it, when a mother has her child, the first thing, probably even before she's, you know, hugged her child, is the kid has got a plastic bracelet. From that moment on, that plastic bracelet around its wrist or its ankle, it's then everything else around it, plastic tubes, plastic toys, plastic bottles, plastic. And we wonder where we're getting all these low-level toxicities from. Well, we are surrounding ourselves with a product that is oil-based, carcinogenic-based, and we're covering ourselves, smothering ourselves with it, from our clothes to our baby products to our toys to the food we're eating being full of plastic. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that actually this is a massive health issue.
Did that reality make it hard to find corporate sponsorship for this project?
It does, yeah. I mean, it made it hard to find, you know, a lot of I think a lot of people primarily were worried that if the boat was to sink, you know, it's not a good look. You know, it's like today, you know, X, Y, and Z corporation was responsible for polluting and killing X number of people. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting now is now we've completed the voyage, how many companies come up to say, you know, we were watching from afar and we think you're great. And can we put our logo on the side and take it on a tour? And you go, well, you know what? I think we should probably just, you know, we should wait and see what happens. And I mean, listen, I'm a great believer in we haven't got time to sit on the fence and point fingers at corporations, same as we haven't got time to sit on the fence and point fingers at politicians. We're at a time right now where we realize that we're having a massive impact on our planet, and the only losers are us. Nature's going to be fine. Our planet's still going to be here. And what we need to do is start to find some harmony between businesses, between citizens, and between governments, and say if we don't start working pretty, you know, sharpish and fast on these issues, we really have got some very uncomfortable decisions to be made. And so why we're not doing it is beyond me. And so what we need to do is encourage companies. If a company says, I'm going to get a little bit better, rather than say, oh, well, you're awful everywhere else, say, fine, get a little bit better, and then start on something else. If a politician says, listen, I'm going to have to make an uncomfortable decision today, but in 10 years' time or 15 years' time, your children will thank me for it, we need to embrace those politicians. And as citizens, we need to recognize that we are in control. We need to take control of who we vote for and who we buy from. If we can do that and collectively do that, we're going to start to see some real gains. And it's totally possible. It's a positive story. What's frustrating is our lack of actual action on the solutions that we have available.
We just have about 15 seconds. Are you already thinking about the next project you will take
always,
on?
Always, always, always. You're going to have to invite me back. I can't tell everything at once. But we're always thinking about giving nature a voice through storytelling. It's what we do. You can find out more on myoo.com or theplastiki.com, or you can find me at Dr. Explore on Twitter.
Great. Well, let's stay in touch. Thank you so much for being with us, David.
Thanks, Chris. Really appreciate it.
David DeRothschild is an environmentalist adventurer who conceived the Plastiki Project. His new book is called Plastiki, Across the Pacific on Plastic, An Adventure to Save Our Oceans. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.